Welcome to Linguistic Voices on Campus, a podcast series produced at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This series deals with common beliefs about language. Scholars from UW-Madison will discuss these beliefs through the lens of their own research. My name is Anja Wanner. I'm a professor of English here at UW-Madison, and today I will discuss linguistic aspects of the language of Shakespeare. My guest is Professor Richard Knowles, professor of English here at UW-Madison, and one of the general editors of the new Variorum edition of Shakespeare's works, which is published under the auspices of the Modern Language Association.
You are now listening to part two of this podcast.
Early modern English was also a time of syntactic change, and change usually begins with variation. In grammar, it is rare that two forms coexist and mean exactly the same. Usually one form takes on a more specialized meaning. A case in point is the English pronominal system. In Old English, for example, thou was used for the second person singular and you was used for the second person plural. But in the 13th century, people copied the French use of the pronouns tu and vous, and tu is the form used for the second person singular, and vous is a polite form of address. And they began to use you as a polite form of the second person singular. Children would use the polite form to address their parents, servants would use the polite form to address their employers. I believe we generally see this pattern in Shakespeare as well. Is that right?
It's in German, is it not also?
Du German und sie, has the yes. Two forms.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about Spanish.
But children would not use sie to address their parents, for example.
Certainly not. Yes.
Not in this century.
Yeah. I think that pattern is fairly consistent in Shakespeare. There have been whole books written about it. And the word that we use in talking about the variations is register. In English literary studies, it means the tonal quality of the speech. So if at the beginning of, for instance, King Lear, a couple of men are gossiping together in prose, they would probably use thou or thee with each other. But as soon as the king comes in, the court comes in and nobility is present, then the whole tone of the scene changes mm-hmm. to something more formal and grand. And so then people will start saying you. But it also, of course, changes with the attitude of the speaker towards the person. When King Lear addresses Cordelia lovingly, he will say thou or thee. But when she crosses his wishes, it's you. When he speaks to the other daughters, expecting good things from them, he says thou. But when they cross him, he says you hags, and so on. So I think Shakespeare does use that as an unconscious signal to the audience that a mood, an attitude, a degree of seriousness, of formality has changed in the scene itself.
Yeah. A bone of contention for many observers of language is the use of adjectives versus adverbs. In English, adverbs that are derived from adjectives are usually marked by the suffix -ly. So one may be a happy person, but one laughs happily. In German, on the other hand, one would use the same word. There is a tendency in colloquial present-day English to drop the -ly. We hear people say something like, he did it real quick, instead of he did it really quickly. Interestingly, this is something that we also find in Shakespeare's works. For example, Rosalind in As You Like It says, thou speakest wiser than thou art aware of, while later in the drama the clown uses wisely. Does this mean that Shakespeare didn't know his grammar?
It's a mischievous question you're asking me. You know, I'm sure, that there are several grammars of Shakespearean English. 1870, a man named Edwin Abbott wrote a Shakespearean grammar for the use of schoolchildren so that they could see how Shakespeare's language was like or unlike their own. Anyway, he wrote a grammar of about 400 pages or so. That work was done more rigorously by a German scholar named Wilhelm Franz in his Shakespeare Grammatik, which is about 700 pages long. So, yes, there was a grammar. Shakespeare followed rules, consciously or unconsciously. This business of the adverb is an interesting one. You've given examples of how words can be used as adverbs without the ly suffix or affix. Thou didst it excellent well. Mm-hmm. 'Tis noble spoken. 'Tis wondrous strange, not wondrously strange. I'll do it straight, not straightly. It alone is high fantastical, not highly fantastical. Mm-hmm. So it's very common in Shakespeare. What interests me is that the ly suffix was, in fact, fairly recent. It came into the language only in the 15th century, really. There were traces of it earlier. The ly suffix goes back a long way. As I understand it, originally was the word like. This is fast, I'll do it fast, like. Mm-hmm. And the leak became shortened to leak and lee, fastly. But that was fairly recent. In earlier English, the adverbs were formed, I think, by putting an e on the end. So you would say quick or quicker. I'm not sure that's a true example.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the final e in Chaucer's time came to be unpronounced. So
happened to a lot of affixes in English.
Did it? Uh-huh. So that the adjectival and adverbial forms sounded exactly the same when spoken, so people stopped worrying about it. And then in the 15th century, the ly begins to be tacked mm-hmm. on, and sometimes it's tacked on and sometimes it's not. We still have a few words in English. The river runs fast and deep, for instance. Or you say, it sure is a nice day. Double negatives, do without the ly, I cannot go no further, nor never, none shall win my heart. And double negatives, of course, are another rule of adjectives that you're not supposed
to use. Students always love that in my class, to point out that Shakespeare uses them, and so can I.
Uh-huh.
But not always to the same dramatic effect. There's one syntactic phenomenon, and that's actually the last syntactic phenomenon I'd like to discuss, that's the grammaticalization of the verb do. Grammaticalization means that a verb loses its semantic meaning and takes on a grammatical function. So it becomes necessary in a sentence, but it doesn't necessarily make any semantic contribution to the sentence. For example, the verb have, which normally expresses possession, in I have not seen him, has become an auxiliary verb. It doesn't indicate possession whatsoever. Another case is go, in I'm going to see her, which in modern English doesn't imply that you're actually going somewhere. It just indicates future. And the same thing happened to do. In modern English, we need the verb do to form a question or to negate a sentence if there's no other auxiliary in the sentence. It is ungrammatical to say, saw you him? It has to be, did you see him? There's no choice in modern English. David Dennison, the historical linguist, argues that the grammaticalization of do took place in the 14th and 15th century. Now, interestingly, in Shakespeare's work, we see a lot of variation. So we see two forms next to each other, and there doesn't seem to be a systematic difference. There are questions with and without do, for example. So we have questions like, looks it not like the king? And did you not speak to it? That's from Hamlet. And what means your lordship? Also, where did I leave? So one question is with do and one is without. Are these two forms in free variation? Or is there any pattern behind them? I've also heard about the theory that the more instances of do you have, since it's the younger form, the younger the play must be. So people use or count the instances of do to date the play. What's your take on that?
Shakespeare obviously was hearing it both ways, and here is another instance, I think, in which the language was in flux at the time. Yes, you do have lots of questions. Revolt our subjects? Gives not the hawthorn bush a sweeter shade? And so on. And you do have negatives, either with or without do. It not appears to me, instead of it does not appear so to me. And there's been a good deal of discussion about whether do is used for particular purposes. Sometimes, of course, it's there just to make regular meter. When I did him at this advantage take, you're putting the do or the did mm-hmm. in there just to fill out the metrical line. And sometimes it just implies excited speech. Ghost did squeak and gibber in the streets. You don't have to say did squeak. You said they squeaked. The do doesn't necessarily have an emphatic force to it.
So do we see an increase in the use of these forms for questions and negation in plays that are younger?
I don't know. I've never done a study of that. These linguistic changes tend to happen over centuries, mm-hmm. don't they, rather than over a couple of decades in the theater. I mean, the big age of the theater was 1590 to 1620, so I would be surprised if you counted a real change.
We have talked about specific phenomena from phonology, morphology, and syntax. Now, to put it all together, overall, how would you rate Shakespeare's influence on the English language as we speak it today?
It's a cliché to say that the two most important influences on the language that we speak are the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer and Shakespeare. In the case of the Bible, it's because it was read every Sunday, read in some households every day, so that the particular cadences and quality of language of the Bible became absorbed. People quoted the Bible, of course, in speech after speech. Shakespeare is a much more varied kind of language, of course. He uses registers of speech and slang and obscenities and so on that you don't find in the language, language of the Bible. And the reason he becomes influential is that he becomes adopted in the 18th century as the national poet, the glory of England. And every Englishman has to know Shakespeare, and every Englishman does somehow. Part of the appeal of Shakespeare is simply the richness of the language that he uses, and many of the phrases that he coined are still in existence. And all sorts of words which are and phrases which originate with Shakespeare have stayed in the language. It beggars all description. It's a foregone conclusion. Head in front, hoist with his own petard, in my mind's eye, that way madness lies. Here is metal more attractive. Even the word weird, for instance, as in the Weird Sisters, weird is another noun. It originally meant fate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become an adjective. I mean, strange, the way those Weird Sisters in Macbeth are strange. Part of it, of course, is the sheer brilliance of what Shakespeare does that makes other people want to repeat him and to imitate him. This is imaginative language, imaginative seeing of the world in ways that are unforgettable, and people, of course, hold those phrases in their memory. I suppose as much as anything else, the sheer variety of language that you find in Shakespeare is something that other later writers, for instance, want to imitate. This was part of the education of the day. Theory of education derived from Erasmus, a book he wrote called Copia Verborum Ac Rerum, or Rerum Ac Verborum. The idea of education is to give people copiousness, plenitude, fullness, and they were taught, for instance, to keep notebooks. One kind of material you would record there was epithets, epitheta, the epitheton. And you would simply make a list of all the different synonyms for the same mm-hmm. quality or epithets for the same thing. And some of Shakespeare's passages are just epithets or synonyms piled up. And Shakespeare's simply having fun with this. My favorite example of the richness is the passages of insults and swearing that you find from time to time in Shakespeare. In fact, there are several books now of Shakespearean insults.
But I've seen lists, yeah.
Put together by a high school teacher, and you take one adjective from the first column
yeah.
and the second one from the second column, so you can call someone a loggerheaded, swag-bellied measle or a tottering, flap-mouthed canker blossom or something of the sort. And I recommend this to my students. Says you ought to have fun with your swearing. You ought to not use the same two or three words all the time, but enjoy the riches of the language. Well, there's a speech in King Lear where Oswald comes upon Kent, his enemy, in the night and doesn't recognize him and says, "What dost thou know me for?" And Kent says, "I know you to be a knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, hundred-pound, filthy, worsted-stocking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking, whore-son, glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, a one-trunk inheriting slave, one that would be a bawd, a pimp in way of good service, and art nothing but the composition of a knave, beggar, coward, pander, and the son and heir of a mongrel bitch." That's delicious. Who would not want to draw on such language as that? I won't go through and explain every word. They all mean something very precise. A rascal, for instance, means a mangy, skinny deer that's been the runt of the litter in the herd mm-hmm. of deer, for instance. I think Shakespeare is influential because he makes us love language, makes us want to use language as richly as he himself did.
Thank you, Professor Knowles, for sharing your passion for Shakespeare's works and his language. And I hope we could show that if you study Shakespeare, even if you don't look at the metaphors and even if you don't look at the complexity of the characters that he creates, we can still be in awe of the variety of language that he uses and the creativity that he employs. If you're interested in the list of dictionaries that we mentioned or in the list of swearing words that Professor Knowles mentioned, you can go to our website and there will be links. This concludes our podcast for today. You can subscribe to our podcast by going to our website. Just look for Linguistic Voices on Campus. Thank you.